This is a second interview with Clarence Thronson, who served with the Navy Construction Corps, the Seabees Construction Battalion, during World War II. And the date of this interview is September 20th, Saturday at 4 p.m. And the interviewer is Jessica Williams. And we left off with you telling us about moving your camp after the Marines took over, and you thought of a way to move all the tents without having to take them down. Is there anything more you want to talk about that?
I remembered you were talking about highlights.
Yes.
You know. Mm-hmm. And I guess quite important one that I forgot about was we were stationed, I think it was in, we were on the east coast. We were stationed, I don't know whether it was in Rhode Island or one of those places we stopped before the war. And they were training pilots there. Mm-hmm. And they had a plane called a Hell Diver. And they only carried one bomb and a machine gun. Mm-hmm. And it was a two-passenger vehicle to fight. And that the reason they call it a dive bomber, they carried one bomb, and the idea was that they'd get up there in the air out where they couldn't see them, and then they'd come out of the sun and maybe on air carriers or, you know, had that one bomb. Mm-hmm. And that was what they called a hell diver. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't mean anything to me except that we were close to it. And one day we were there at the base, and a fellow by the name of Eddie Casey and I were there, and they had the young pilots, you know. They were fresh out of college, and in order to be a hell diver, you know, you better been a hell diver, you know. Well, anyhow, they were going up to practice, and they said, "You want to go along?" Well, yeah, and the idea was they'd take us up and they'd go through all kinds of maneuvers, loop-de-loop, and then finally they'd head for the ground. And the idea was, those kids, you know, young, they'd if you rode with them, the idea was they'd try to make you upchuck. They'd scare you, in other words, you know. Well, I went up, and Casey and I went up, and two pilots went up, and they went through their motions, and Casey did. He got sick, mm-hmm. and the pilot made him clean it up. But I never got sick. The only thing is, you can't believe, when he dived down like this and pulled out like that, if you had your hands down, you couldn't raise them. You couldn't raise your hands. The force towards the earth was so hard. But the planes were not very successful. They didn't use them too much, but they trained them, you know, had pilots trained for them. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the highlights that I hadn't. And then I guess I don't know, you know, I told you about building those quadrants, you know, four quadrants, yes. And they put one foreman. In other words, I was one foreman. I had a crew, and the other groups had a crew, and we'd always have a little contest to see who'd get done first. Mm-hmm. Well, I kept getting done first all the time, and so as we went on, my crew got, well, in every, we had 75 people, mm-hmm. 75, about 75 or 80. And you know, and I know, that in every group there is somebody, that some of the group that isn't very productive, let's put it that way. They try to shirk away. Well, you wouldn't believe this, but the last one was in Maine. We were up in Maine, and I got the crew, all of the crew that was, the group that was, everybody knew, you know, they were. So when I got them, you know, I looked at them, and I said, "My God," I said, "We'll be here all week." Well, they took it good-naturedly, and I don't know why, but I guess I always had everybody kind of wanted to work for me. All my life, people wanted to do good for me. I don't know why, but that was kind of the way I was. I never hit anybody over the head to ever do anything for me, but But we went at it again, and by God, they kept saying, slave driver, slave driver, slave driver. But they were anxious to get done and show that they were, you know, and by God, we finished again ahead of the rest. So that was another kind of a thing that I wanted to remember about. Then the last place we built a catapult was in Maine. And they were teaching British pilots there in Maine. They had different kind of food. You know, they were mutton eaters. They liked mutton. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we all ate at the same chow hall, and they had a lot of mutton, and mutton, you know, oh, stinks, I think. So you could smell the chow hall quite a ways away. So that's what I remember about Maine when we built that. Limeys, they were called, you know, those British kids learning to be pilots. They called them Limeys.
Why?
That was their nickname, you know. They were Limeys. They called them Limeys.
Why would, what's that mean?
Well, it was a British, it's like, you know, you have a pet name for somebody, uh-huh. You know, and that was, they were Limeys.
Okay.
So I wanted to mention that as a highlight, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I guess we got to Okinawa and we were... When I left here, and getting ready to go home, they had a point system, mm-hmm. and you had to get so many points in order to be able to be discharged and head for home. Mm-hmm. Well, some of my buddies went for home before I did, and when they went for home or got a ride for home. They would ride anything that was there that was going to the States. If they could get on it and there was room for them, they would ride on. We had a fellow by the name of Harry Harding, I guess I talked about, that was our water tender. He was from Springfield, Illinois. He got a ride back on an aircraft carrier. So he was bragging about, when I talked to him after the war, about how great a ride he had. Harry Harding was, he worked on the railroad. I think he was, worked on an engine, you know, a steam engine. Mm-hmm. And part of his job was to make sure that the boiler was full of water. So they call him a water tender. Mm-hmm. And that's how come he got in the service as a water tender.
Okay.
So he was the water tender at our camp mm-hmm. in Okinawa. And I guess I told you about one day we went out for a walk and found a body in the creek where we were drawing our water for drinking and for everything. But he always said, that's no problem. He said, your water's okay.
Did you boil it?
Well, of course we notified and of course the authorities went and, you know, and recovered, you know, the body. But he paid no attention to it. He said, I'm putting so much chemicals in it. He said, you couldn't possibly get sick, you know, from the water.
Huh.
So I suppose you could probably pail it out of any place and put the chemicals in it to keep it from contaminating you, you know.
Hmm. That's interesting.
And, of course, we had a good time about it, you know, in teasing and so forth. I always teased him about he was on the... He always was telling stories about riding on the car, on the engine, you know. And how well he tended and all that good stuff. We always talking about our great points of our own, you know.
Uh-huh.
So we always kidded each other about that. And, of course, he kidded me back about... You know, that I was filling those kids full of baloney. The seamen, you know.
Uh-huh.
We always had seamen around, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, for working. Mm-hmm. Well, they always, for some reason or other, they kind of liked me, and if I was at, around some place, they kind of come around and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I did film, a little, with a little imaginary stuff, but they loved it, you know.
Like, what did you tell them?
Well, I don't remember much stories, and Harry, if he would hear it, he said, "You son of a bitch." Telling those young kids all those stories. So we had a lot of fun about that. So he thought I was filming them full of crap. Yeah. But one thing I was going to, that I didn't mention the other day, I guess, you know, preparatory to coming home, we had supplies, mm-hmm. mountains of supplies, Quonset huts, mm-hmm. stacked together, you know. So the last, about the last 3 weeks or so that I was there, we dug holes in the ground and put all of these supplies in the hole and covered them up because they wasn't going to haul it home, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't want it to go to somebody else. Mm-hmm. So we buried a lot of Quonset huts and other supplies and copper wire, all that good stuff. We buried a lot of that, dug big holes and put it in there and covered it up.
You think anybody would ever go back and dig it up?
Well, who knows? By now, right. You know, maybe they, well, I'm sure, and the poor people that were there, they had been run over, and military had taken everything over, and of course the civilians or the women and cripples, let's put it away, or was left, mm-hmm. you know, and the children. So they were left to do the harvesting and all that stuff. Mm. And I remember the women had little grub hoes, and they were they weren't a potato, but they were like sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. And they planted those, and then they had a man, he was always, when I saw, there was always an older fellow, he was the boss. Mm-hmm. And the women had these little grub hoes, you know, keeping, cultivating. Mm-hmm. So that was the natives after the military had swept over, you know, and were getting ready to go to Japan. Mm-hmm. They were... Okinawa would have been really the jump-off place, mm-hmm. for Japan,
okay.
if the war would have continued. Mm-hmm. So there was a big preparation, military preparation, mm-hmm. on Okinawa. When I got ready, got my points and got ready to go home, I didn't draw a very good ship. I draw an old freighter that had been out there forever, I guess. And another guy that got on that same one, I guess I told you last week about, he got in trouble with a commanding officer, and he was going to make a private out of him before he sent him home.
I don't think you told that story.
A half stripe. Yeah, he was a... Well, the first thing you get if you get braid is a half stripe. That's half of a second lieutenant.
Okay.
You know, it's gold. You've got gold, and you've got authority, and you can use that. But this fellow was part of our outfit over there, and he, up in the officer's quarters, they got drunk, I guess, and in a fight or something like that. And in the morning, early about 6 o'clock or so, I had a runner come to my tent, and he said, "You're wanted down at the equipment tent." Well, okay, I thought it was my commanding officer wanted something like that. I got down there, and it was this half-stripe. Mm. And insulted the commanding officer, I guess, or something, and the commanding officer said, I'm going to send you home a private. And he lived in Texas, and he was shedding tears and everything, and everybody at home thought he was an officer or knew he was an officer, and he'd come home, wouldn't have any rank at all, and he'd come home just a grunt. So he wanted to know if I'd intervene for him. And I said, why do you think I can do anything for you? I said, I can't do anything for you. You know, I said, that's up to you guys up there on the hill. You've got your own problem. If you're fighting, you better do your own fighting. He said, there's only one fellow in this camp can get me home. So I'm not a private, he said. Only one. And he said, and that's you. Why? You're nuts. Well, he said, you're the only guy that, the commanding officer, you're the only one in camp the commanding officer will listen to. And because, well, I spent more time with the commanding officer than I did with anybody else. That's why they were calling me Brown Nose, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, he come to me and he wanted to know if I'd intervene for him. And I said, well, you know, that ain't quite right. I'm just a seaman, in other words, a first-class seaman, and I shouldn't be going up to the Goldbraith and asking him for... He said, don't make any difference. He said, you're the only guy that can save me. Well, we all ate in the same chow hall. Uh-huh. The Goldbraith and everybody ate in the same chow hall. Well, that morning, when I went up to the chow hall, I kind of waited around for Lieutenant, or Captain Hahn was his name. Uh-huh. And I waited around for him, and so I went through the chow line. We sat down across from each other on the table and had breakfast. Mm-hmm. And when we got done, why, I broached the subject and said, what the hell's going on up at the, up on the hill? Mm-hmm. What are you guys fighting about? He was kind of quiet and ugly and mm-hmm. so forth, and I said, I can't bring his name back. He was from Texas. Anyhow, he said he wanted to talk to me this morning, and he told me that he was in trouble, and he thought that maybe I could intervene and for him and maybe plead for him mm-hmm. so that he could, so you wouldn't punish him. Mm-hmm. Well, Hans said he's going to punish him. That's all there's to it. Mm-hmm. So we talked and talked and talked and when we got walked out of the chow hall together, I said, well, Hon, I said, you better think it over some. You know, it won't do you any good, and it'll do him a lot of harm for his family and so forth. So I don't, why, you know, you'll never see him again in your life when he goes home. And so I don't know whether it'll make you happy. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't say answer one way or another, but he did. He didn't punish him. Mm-hmm. He let him go.
Good.
And when we got ready to go home, he was on the same ship I was. But I would begin to talk about that ship coming home. I got on an old army freighter that had been out there for, I don't know, for months or whatever, mm-hmm. going from island to island or whatever, hauling, you know. And the food was all rotten, mm-hmm. except they had taken on potatoes. They had, out there at an island somewhere, they had taken on new, fresh potatoes. Mm-hmm. But other than that, everything... The chickens were rotten, everything. You won't believe this, and I know people won't believe it. They look at me and think that guy is making up stories, but I lived through it. I took 21 days to get home uh-huh. from Okinawa to Seattle. And they didn't even have small stores like peanuts and candy or anything. They had nothing like that. And we started out, and it was kind of calm. The only thing that was the bad start was that when we went to chow, we had chicken and beans and so forth. The chicken, they put out in big kettles, and they cook it, and all the meat fell off the bones, and that come to the top, and the bones went to the bottom.
And that's how they served it?
Well, I think somebody saw a package, and they said it'd been out, those chickens were 8 years old. Been in the freezer for 8 years,
oh,
or seven
God.
Or 8 years they'd been in the freezer. And then, as we went through the chow hall, they had beans. And I thought, my God, they got beans and rice together. I said, I've never seen that in my life. You know, beans in the Navy was great. They were great for beans. Here they had beans and rice together. I've never seen beans and rice together before. Well, they put beans on my platter, and I got back to sit down, and here they were, maggots, with little brown heads on them, and the beans. There was as many maggots as there was beans.
And they served you that?
Well, I see some fellows did. They pushed the maggots aside like that and ate the beans, but I never did. Then they had boll weevils in the bread, so it looked like raisin bread.
Oh, my gosh. Yuck. What did you live on?
I didn't live on. I lost 21 pounds on the way home.
Oh, my gosh. 21 pounds in 21 days.
That's the only thing I ate was potatoes. But their potatoes were fresh. They had picked them up out there on an island, and they were fresh. Well, anyhow, that was my trip home. Which I'll have to say is something I've remembered well. We come back to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was quite a shock because then they were treating everybody just great, you know, had butter on the table. And of course, I hadn't seen butter for months.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was, they fed us pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there for, I don't know, several days, and then we started for home and come across, it was in December, and come across that northern states.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cold, I remember that, and they had big round cans of, about twice as round as this, of canned heat. And they had that in the middle of the car that you were in. They had that in the middle of the car and had that burn. It burned slow.
Mm-hmm.
Stink. And hard on the eyes, you know. You wanted to have the windows open. It was so bad. But that was the only heat there was. So there was nothing in the, you know, you know how trains are. They hook from one to the other, and they put steam through them. Apparently, they were broke down as far as I was concerned. So they had canned heat. And they were big round buckets like that, and they smoldered, and, you know, they were...
What was it, like coal?
Yeah, no. It was some chemical
of
some kind.
Huh.
I remember it was red. And unless it was the fire coming out of it, I don't know, but I remember that. But I know it was hard on the eyes. So that from time to time, you'd want to get the door open and, in between cars so you could get a little fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
But we come along pretty good across the, in other words, it was an old, about a 19... or turn of the century train, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that would go on tracks they used during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
They resurrected all those old cars, you know, and I suppose that's why they didn't have any heat, because
they were so old.
Kind of broke down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And got to Seattle, and where that was there for a few days, and they fed us I thought was pretty good, and I was I guess I was getting fattened up. So it took about 7 days to come from Seattle to Chicago, and I got discharged in Chicago,
okay.
Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife was in Chicago working for the Red Cross at that time. And she had a room up kind of on the north side with an old Swedish lady.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as quick as I got to town, I called her and so forth and got my discharge papers and picked her up the same day. And we were in Mount Horeb that night.
Wow.
So when I got discharged, I didn't hang around, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, I was happy to be with my wife again and so forth. And it was approaching Christmas in 1945. And so it was a happy time, you know. When we was in the service, I got a stipend from the money I was supposed to make, and Delma got $50 a month for herself, and then she got a homestead of $100 a month to take care of the home, you know,
okay.
while we were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So she had charge of $150, or $100, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And so she, and we had a rented a home down on Springdale Street, upstairs home.
Mm-hmm.
Paid $15 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept that all the time. My Delma's dad lived with us.
Mm-hmm.
I inherited him along with the marriage.
That's what you said.
Yeah. Which was a good man. He was. He was a nice man. Easy to get along with. And, yeah. And he lived with us till he passed away. And I could have stayed, and my commanding officer said if I wanted to stay on Okinawa till he went home,
mm-hmm.
he could give me like a battlefield commission.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't about to. When I got my points, I was headed for home because I guess in my mind there was two things. I wanted to get back to normal, and I never made any money. I never gained, you know, when I was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get back to where I could earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main reason why I didn't hang around. A friend of mine from Indiana, he stayed.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed, and he got to be a half stripe.
Mm-hmm.
Got promoted to half stripe. And he come home. He was in construction.
Mm-hmm.
And we were pretty good buddies. He was one of the fellows that I competed with quite a bit when we were in charge of things. Poor fellow, though, he went back, and he was in part of the construction business, too, and the poor fellow tipped a tractor over and got killed. Not very long after he got home, about 6 months or so after he got home. So that was an unhappy circumstance. And I'll have to say that my military experience was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I was unhappy because I thought everything went too slow.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get things done, and, you know, it was too much red tape, and so it took too long. But I had come from construction where I'd been working 10, 12 hours a day and accomplishing, you know. But when I got in the service, there wasn't. That's a different can of worms.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I wasn't unhappy with my trip in the service, but I did what probably done me in better stead than anything was that I learned more about people mm-hmm. and how to manage people. Mm-hmm. Because that's all I did. You know, when I was overseas, I was called upon for more than that. But, I mean, in the service, first-class machinist mate, that's all they do. They're a foreman. Mm-hmm. They don't have to touch a shovel or do anything. So I was always in charge of somebody or something, you know, and with people. So I did find out about people, you know, in other words. So I think that was good for me, mm-hmm. because all my life I've dealt with people, mm-hmm. you know. And so I guess with that, I think that's about all.
Well, I had some questions for you. You were saying that you had the nickname of Tonto.
Yep.
How'd you get that nickname?
Well, before the war, when we got out of high school, it was nickel and dime economy. Uh-huh. Bad, bad, bad. We were in a depression, uh-huh. you know. And so I went up to La Crosse to go to school, college up there. I had a French professor that was teaching history, and he could never pronounce Thronson. He got Tonton or something like that. He got it every time, and we come here for a thing, our Christmas for vacation, and Bobby Vazen had a bowling alley down here, and a fellow by the name of Call, he and I were up at La Crosse at the same time. We graduated from school together. And so he heard this name for this Frenchman was trying to pronounce Tonton or something like that. And so he was calling me Tonton when he was in the bowling alley down here, or we were playing cards or something like that. And one day, after a while, why, Bubby had heard this, and he was back of the bar washing glasses, and what the hell was that they called you, Tano, or Clarence? Tonto, he says. Well, from that day on, everybody in the tavern called me Tonto, and it just spread. Uh-huh. So I was known by all my friends and my wife. She called me Tonto more than she called me anything else. She wasn't happy about Clarence. So she called me Tonto. So my nickname was Tonto. It's like Limeys, you know, what uh-huh. I was trying to tell you, yeah. you know, about Limeys. So I got to be Tonto all my life. I got to, now, of course, my circle of friends is smaller and so forth. So there's the Euchre people all call me Tonto yet. But uh-huh. I mean, but other than that, why not as many people call me Tonto? But mm-hmm. but of course, all through my life, I was involved in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I was on the village board for 28 years, wow. and so. That was why I guess I was, and I think everybody called me that as a kind of an affectionate name, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Well, another question I had, it says on your papers that you were a rifle expert, and I was just wondering how you got that category if you were in the construction part of the Navy. How did you get to be a rifle expert?
Well, we had, it was in training.
Okay.
Of course, you see, I used a rifle on the farm to hunt rabbits, and so we used a lot of rifle on the farm. Mm-hmm. So when I got in service and we had target practice, hey, that was nothing for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I could hit the bullseye every time. Mm-hmm. And so that's how come.
Okay.
I never paid much attention to this, to the ribbons I got, but that was one, a rifle expert. The other one was, of course, the Asian theater.
Okay.
And then I got a good conduct. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was something else, too, you know, that I got. I don't know where they are or what happened to them or so forth. I suppose Delma took care of all of it. Well, I don't know why they put that on there. But I was in the Asian theater, too, you know, so that should have been on there.
What's it say?
Oh, yeah, in the American theater. Oh, Victory Medal. I got 4 medals. The Victory Medal must have been for good conduct. Well,
let's see.
It wasn't that I was seeking medals, it was just that I was
it
there.
Happened. Yeah.
Right.
I wrote down something last time called, I wrote down the word twist.
Albert Twist.
Yes, you were going to talk about him.
He was, I don't know, you had a, we got a picture of him and I hanging out our clothes in, with shorts on.
Okay.
With our briefs on, I mean, because we used to wash our clothes in a garbage can, you know. And Albert Twist was from Vermont. And, oh, he was, I don't know whether he was a, I think he was a second-class man. He hadn't, he had, he was in the Pepsi-Cola. He delivered Pepsi-Cola in New England, and was going back to that. I liked him. He was a good humor, kind of that New England humor and everything. And so poor fellow didn't live very long, though, after he went home, and I don't know why. But his name was Albert Twist. And I don't, you know, you don't remember everybody's name, but I remember his, so he must have impressed me. Yeah, but he was a nice man. Right. Wrote to me, or we wrote back and forth after the war, and but he didn't live very long. He went back to selling Pepsi, and was happy. Finally, every one of those, there was a dozen people. I got notice from their wives after they passed away, and here I am still. But they're all gone. Every one of them. I used to hear from Han quite a bit. He'd call me on the telephone.
Did he ever come and visit?
Well, no. But I never encouraged anybody because after the war, you know, we got in the construction business and, hey, we got into that with no money. Not enough money, let's put it that way. And it's a very capital-intensive business. Takes a lot of money to run it. So, I guess I was hurrying to get, you know, to do. I couldn't take time off to go anyplace because every day I had to be in charge and on the job. So I couldn't go to New England or any place. We had reunions, you know, about every 5 years. And he called me, "Boy, now you're coming this time, aren't you?" But I never went. No. And a fellow that I had to mention, that fellow by his name of Eddie Casey, he lived in New England, Massachusetts. And I guess this is a highlight I never talked about. But on St. Patrick's Day in 19, I don't know what, anyhow, on St. Patrick's Day, must have been in 44, we went up to his home, which was North Attleboro. North Attleboro is a kind of a jewelry center, you know, like not high-priced jewelry. They're kind of a middle-class jewelry center, North Attleboro, Massachusetts. And everybody there was seemed to be in that jewelry business. Well, went with him on St. Patrick's Day. With him, he had a wife and child at home, and I stayed with them. I took a quart of whiskey along. I remember that. So, as a contribution to my staying there, and then on on the St. Patrick's Day here, he was amongst all his friends. He was Irish himself, and he was married to an English woman. And so he had more English relatives than he did Irish. But he was really Irish. He could sing Danny Boy like a bird. He was right. And the female flocked to him because he could sing Danny Boy so good. Well, anyhow, we had to go downtown then that day and to the taverns, and they, it wasn't all beer. They had what, half a beer and half what they call musty. It was an ale, and they mixed the two together. They'd draw half the glass of beer and the other half of musty, which was ale. So that's what everybody drank. Everybody drank. And, of course, let's say we started early and we drank a long time. And I was the only Scandinavian in town. And, of course, I was teasing him about, you know, being Scandinavian and so forth. But I got along with him just fine and got through the day and so forth. After, Evans Case was the name of one of the jeweler people. Mm-hmm. When I got back to camp, they sent me 5 lighters, Evans Case cigarette lighters. Because I was a serviceman, see, and these people working for Evans Case, give me your name and I'll send you a lighter.
Oh, that's funny.
And I got 5 of them from being up there on St. Pat's Day in 1944. Right. So I had a big time, I have to say that. That's one St. Pat's Day I'll remember.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to...
Well, I don't know right offhand, no.
When you came back, did you...
Well, I joined the American Legion when I come back.
Okay.
And that's the only organization I joined, but I'm not active.
Mm-hmm.
Never have been, and there was another thing. You know, I was in too many things.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in a rut.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't do much with, in the service. I still belong mm-hmm. after 50 years, but I'm not very active.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I guess I told you that all of my friends are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And
is Holly your only daughter? Or did you have more kids?
Pardon?
Is Holly your only daughter, or did you
yeah.
have more kids?
She was, when we were, after the war, we lived down on Springdale Street.
Mm-hmm.
And Delma's dad was still living with us. And then she was born when we were there. And she was there, we lived there, she was, I don't know, maybe 3 by the time we moved away from there. We paid $15 a month, and I was so ashamed of paying that $15 that I raised it to $25. But other than that, I might find something else, but I think that's pretty well
okay.
covers it.
All right. Well, thank you.